From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for August 21st, 2020. Your Milwaukee Bucks continue their playoff series with the Magic in the Orlando bubble. And the Brew Crew is in Pittsburgh for a weekend series with the Pirates. As every parent or grandparent knows, there's no pain like walking around the house barefoot and stepping on a Lego. Well, this is worse. A Lego piece fell out of a New Zealand boy's nose after being stuck up there for nearly 2 years. The good news is they can finally finish the Millennium Falcon. Kanye West's lawyer demanded that Wisconsin Democrats prove Mickey Mouse didn't really sign his presidential petition. This begs the question, how many other signers of Kanye's petition don't wear pants? Maybe that's why it was denied. Thanks to social distancing, sales of deodorant are down, but if you're one of those savers, we know who you are. Last week, we did a story on zombie cicadas. Today, we have a Texas scientist who discovered a tongue-eating parasite in fish. Just to be clear, the parasite eats fish tongues, not human tongues. But what in the wide world of sports is going on out there? And finally, an airplane was supposed to fly to Australia, loaded down with cocaine. So much coke, in fact, the plane was too heavy to take off. And I thought cocaine was supposed to get you high. Boy, this is a tough crowd, not even a groan. On the podcast today, we have Dave Sandstrom, Mark Amateas, Joel Dreesing, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, thanks, Max. I was definitely laughing at that. I just wanted to let you know that I was practicing good Zoom hygiene, and so I had my microphone muted. But otherwise, you would have heard me laughing for sure. So another great week for stocks this week. The NASDAQ up 2.7%, closing today at 11,312. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, roughly flat for the week, closing today at the bell at 27,931, up 191 points today, but again, roughly flat for the week. And a big milestone for the S&P 500, recapturing new all-time highs, closing today at the bell, another new all-time high, 3,397, up 0.7% for the week. For the year, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, including dividends, now down just 0.9%, so getting pretty close back to that flat level mark for the year. The S&P 500 now up 6.3% for the year, including dividends. And the NASDAQ closing today, 26.7% positive return for the year. That's a pretty big number there for the NASDAQ. Obviously, a lot of those tech stocks driving the bus. But I think maybe the place to jump off this week as we look at kind of the important news is that, you know, we find ourselves now out of this bear market. It was the shortest bear market in history. Maybe some technical notes on that in terms of how we measure bulls and bears. A lot of different ways that people are going to measure this. A lot of different ways that people are going to talk about when we exited the bear, when we entered the bear, when we exited the bull, when we entered the bull. Important to remember that bear market generally defined as a 20% move down in the markets. And the bull market usually begins, at least, based on how we're measuring, when that bear market bottoms out and then recovers back to that previous peak. And so this week, Tuesday, we recovered that previous peak. You look back to the bottom of the bear market, all the way back in the middle of March. And so you had a bear market that lasted just a little bit more than a month. And other ways to measure it, certainly other ways we can talk about it. But no matter how you measure it, we're talking about the shortest bear market in history. I think a lot of reasons for that, a lot of things that drive, maybe what that means. But Mark, we've got you back on the program here for the first time in a while. What are your thoughts on kind of the shortest bear market in history?
Well, I think clearly, Kyle, a big part of the story is the Fed, Congress, the Treasury just doing whatever they had to do to make sure we came out of the COVID as quickly as possible. Lowering interest rates, pumping money into the economy, providing liquidity, backstopping the financial system, all those things, giving confidence to the markets, but also the liquidity has to go somewhere, right? And with interest rates as low as they are, with Chairman Powell of the Federal Reserve saying that, he's going to keep rates low until the end of 2022 for sure, and my guess it'll be even longer than that. I think stocks became one of the only games in town, if not the only game in town, you know? I think that was a huge part of it. You know, and I think part of it too is, again, the market is a leading indicator. It's always looking forward. It doesn't care what happened in the past. It cares what is going to happen in the future. And I think investors, because of the nature of what caused the bear market with COVID, you know, not a typical business cycle recession, I think investors felt that the bear market or the, you know, recession would be short-lived, and that they wanted to get ahead of the game. And they started looking forward and saying, look, 2021 looks awfully good compared to 2020. You know, and it's all about how the future looks compared to the past. And money started moving into stocks, you know, more quickly. And then, of course, momentum just feeds upon itself. Nobody, you know, fear of being left behind is part of it, I think. So all kinds of reasons. You know, the biggest question I'm getting, and I'm sure we'll talk more about it, is where do we go from here? You know, is this it? Or, you know, with election coming up and some other things, you know, what do we do? What's next?
You know, Dave, as far as market return for the bear market, it was a very average bear market, you know, down roughly a little more than 30% for the S&P 500. And I think the big difference between this one and so many of the ones in the past was just how quickly it happened. And just as quickly, we've seen a recovery. And that's the part that maybe is less atypical for that transition from bear to bull. We see historically about 50% of the best days worth of returns for the S&P 500 come in the midst of that bear market. And another 30% of the best days worth of returns for the S&P 500 tend to come in the first 2 months of a bull market. Now, again, a reminder for our listeners, we just got confirmation this week, Tuesday, that we're out of the bear and into the bull, but this bull market is now roughly 5 months old based on the fact that we, again, go back to the bottom of when that bear market was happening. And so for investors who are looking at, okay, all of a sudden we're in a bear market, does that mean that I should suddenly change what I do? You know, I'm sure you have some thoughts on that, but just based on the data, you know, I think market timing in that sense probably doesn't work.
Now, Kyle, I think just kind of going back to your original statement about how quick the slide was into the bear, I think we have to remember that, you know, this, and Mark kind of hit on a little bit, this was not a typical business cycle recession. This was pretty much a one-of-a-kind, at least in most investors' memory banks, that we put the brakes on the entire global economy literally in a matter of a couple of days. Very little data, very little comparative numbers to look on and say, hey, what's going to happen here? So I think the flight to safety was obviously, it was significant and quick. And I think it really points to the idea of not trying to time markets, certainly not trying to guess on what's going to happen, but have that strategic plan in place with that portfolio that's built to handle this type of thing and survive it, right? I mean, you can see what would have happened to you if you had moved out of the stock market at the bottom, thinking that you'd have some time to evaluate what was going on and then suddenly get back in. Well, obviously, when you see where markets have gone to, very few people would have had the courage to re-enter prior to this. So extremely dangerous to try to time things. And, you know, we just don't know what's going to happen. And that's why you got to stick to your plan and have yourself in a position to stop you from making those types of knee-jerk decisions.
You know, I'm listening to a podcast on some of the early history of cartography or the early history of map making, and one of the things that they talked about is before we knew what existed in certain places of the world, you'd have cartographers that would put on the map, here be lions or here be dragons, with this idea that you know, it was an unknown world that we were entering if we entered that place on the map. And I think, you know, in many ways, that's the environment that we've entered with the economy, right? Here be dragons. We don't know what's coming next, but we know that, you know, whatever it is, it's uncertain. And so, you know, I think a question, Dave, that that you've talked to me that you get quite a bit is, okay, if we're dealing with all this uncertainty, if there's really no good reason for why stocks has run as well as they have, you know, what's the underlying force there? Why are we doing as well as we are? And I think, you know, I'm sure you've got a variety of reasons. I know I've got a variety of reasons when I get asked that question about why we are where we are. But, you know, ultimately, it comes down to that uncertainty. And it's not simply a function of uncertainty being a bad thing for stocks. In fact, in some ways, you know, I think uncertainty can be a pretty good thing for stocks.
Yeah, and I think, Kyle, that there are obviously reasons for why we're at where we're at in the markets. I mean, people have said to me, you know, there's no good reason maybe. And that can certainly be debated, but Mark pointed out a few of them. I mean, there are certain areas of the marketplace that are doing extremely well, certain corporations and sectors highly profitable during this. I mean, we see what's going on in the growth world and companies like the FANG stocks, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Google, all writing record numbers here because of their captive audience. But you look at things like zero interest rates, not giving investors a place to go to make any type of return in the safe stuff. You look at this unprecedented stimulus from the U.S. government, $2.5 trillion to start, teeing up possibly another $1 to $3 trillion, depending on how that goes. So those types of stimulus numbers are unprecedented as well. So lots of reasons why, you know, there's one place to be right now, and that's the stock market. You know, the bigger question is, you know, will the vaccine appear? Will we get to the other side of this pandemic successfully and quickly and orderly to allow us to, you know, have some of these market levels, you know, be justified through a return to some more economic normalcy in 2021?
You know, I think worth pointing out, as you say, that the data is not all bad, especially when you look at the economic data. You know, you look at things like, you know, TSA traveler traffic or how many people are coming through TSA checkpoints and year over year down 70% in terms of, you know, kind of that pretty significant measure of air travel. You look at hotel occupancies down a third year over year. You look at seated diners, so the number of people that are actually coming into restaurants down a little more than half year over year. And yet, you know, I think so much of the economy now has transitioned to, we're not sitting down in restaurants anymore, but we're finding new ways to order out, whether it's Uber Eats or other ways to get our food. And so some of that spending has just shifted. And I think that's part of it. The other part is that travel isn't the only thing we measure. Things directly impacted by this pandemic aren't the only things we measure. And so, you know, you look at consumer spending broadly. Debit and credit transactions year over year down just 8%. And so a pretty significant difference between some of the worst data that we look at and things like travel. And I think some of the more broad or wholesale, you know, measures of the U.S. economy and just what kind of transaction rates are we seeing. And it's a little bit down, certainly, but not nearly down as bad as the economy overall is. And then, of course, making the point that the markets are not the economy. And I think that's the piece that investors really need to remember is that if you're buying shares of the S&P 500, 22-23% of what you're buying is Amazon, Apple, Facebook, Microsoft, and Google. And those companies surely have a different path ahead than what, you know, I think the economy broadly has. And so important to remember that if you're buying shares of stocks, you're not buying shares of the economy, you're buying shares of businesses that often are not directly correlated to the path of the economy overall. And I think the other economic piece that has shown some strength relative to, you know, what the rest of the economy looks like is the housing market. And Joel, we got a lot of housing data this week, you know, showing some signs that potentially the housing market is, if not healthy, healthier than much of the rest of the economy.
Yeah, Cal, what it really shows is an acceleration. You know, it's one of those statistical things where we look at numbers that are annualized. We're looking at an annualized rate of existing home sales today from the National Association of Realtors. We looked at annualized rates of new housing starts from the Commerce Department on Monday. And those annualized rates can be kind of confusing, deceiving. I mean, we like to know longer term, you know, how things are moving, but it's sort of like, I don't know, taking somebody's 40-yard dash and then saying, oh, well, you know, this is how quickly they'd run a marathon. Well, it doesn't really work that way. But yeah, good signs. The National Association of Realtors today showed a record increase in that rate of existing home sales in July. It went up 25%. And that beat the record of the month before, which was 20%. So that's pretty cool. The annualized rate of existing home sales was 5.86 million. And that's the highest it's been since December 2006. So that's all impressive. The question, though, is whether that can be sustained. Because in those same numbers, the realtors also showed that inventory was about half the level that they usually think of as being a sustainable rate. They actually called the inventory level dire. So, you know, supply, demand, low mortgage rates, that's what's, you know, driving demand. Along with the realtors are saying that more people, because they're looking at working remotely, want bigger houses. They want to accommodate a lifestyle that means they're not going somewhere else to work. So that's driving demand for housing. And the supply part means, you know, with that dire level of inventory, that housing prices are going up. So the realtors said that for 101 straight months, there's been a year-to-year increase in the median rate, the median sales rate price for a house, and it's now above $300,000 for the first time. So, you know, again, the short-term signs are we're showing an acceleration. In some ways, we're back above where we were before the pandemic, but then there are questions of how this can be sustained.
Well, and I think pricing is obviously a big concern. Affordability has always been kind of a drain on the housing picture. And so as we look at, you know, what I think is pretty encouraging news short-term about the housing market, long-term, there's some questions, as you say, about how sustainable an average median sales price of, you know, $300,000 is for housing. And then, you know, I think just to bring it back to why this is so important, yeah, home builders aren't all that big of a piece of the stock market. You know, the housing market more broadly has lots of pieces to it, though, that I think are important, because those builders are buying things from home supply companies, you know, Home Depot, Lowe's, the like. And, you know, if you're buying a bigger house, it means you've got to buy more furniture. And so the IKEAs of the world are selling more desks for home offices that didn't exist before. And so, you know, I think there are benefits to housing beyond simply the housing market itself. And so it's encouraging to see some short-term strength. I think what we're hoping for is that, you know, this is a sign that the economy can remain on solid footing there and more broadly as well.
And those housing starts, it adds a little, you know, bit of to that inventory piece. So the fact that we're seeing those accelerate is also a positive sign.
And I think too, Joel, what we've seen historically is when you do get these pinches on supply and it forces those home prices up, that obviously is going to entice other people to put their house on the market. You know, people start finding out what their neighbor just sold their house for, all-time record for the neighborhood, then all of a sudden the sales signs start coming up. And so we could see that start to transition into helping that real big crunch on supply right now, which would kind of help to level that off. So that could give this some more legs, I would think, as people start to envision that, oh, I could get a lot more for my house than I thought, and start to maybe move on to the next phase.
Well, and Dave, you always wonder if some of this is just pent up, you know, selling demand as well, that people are waiting to put their house on the market until they're comfortable having people walk through it. Because I can tell you, you know, there's plenty of homes for sale in my neighborhood right now, but there isn't a lot of foot traffic because people just aren't comfortable going through them right now. So I think that's a big piece of it as well. You know, other economic news this week, we had a survey of leading economic indicators, right, Joel?
Yeah, so the once a month, the Conference Board, which is a private business research group, they look at 10 pretty standard indicators that over time they figure show what's going to be happening with the economy. And this month, they came out with numbers for July, and it grew 3%. It grew 1.4%, but it was down from 3% the month before that and 3.1% the month before that. So those are three pretty strong months in a row, again, coming from that, you know, pandemic letdown. So again, you know, making it a good path back. But even with those numbers, the conference board was saying that it appears to be losing steam, that this momentum to recovery is leveling out. And they're saying that overall, you know, for the rest of the year, that they're seeing substantial weakening in the growth rate for the economy. But again, it's going in the right direction.
Continue to be pandemic driven, obviously, and, you know, vaccine will be a big deal, and continued news on treatments and continued randomized controlled trials that prove out different treatments and different types of treatments, I think will be, you know, a big deal to continue to see that data improve. You know, I think maybe the big question that remains is, you know, that interest rates remain near record lows. We've got stocks that have become, I think, meaningfully expensive. And yes, there are reasons to believe that some of that is sustainable. There are reasons to believe that if we see the earnings growth that we expect in 2021, that, you know, the current levels of stock prices may be more appropriate than what many had initially thought. But then, you know, Mark, you look at the fact that we've got an election coming up, we've got plenty of uncertainty around the pandemic. And so I think that the question that so many clients are asking themselves, and I'm sure are asking you, is, you know, what should we expect over the next couple of months? What do we do about it?
Well, Kyle, I'll tell you what I'm telling my clients. And that is, you have to, each individual client with our help has to put themselves in a position where no matter what happens, they're able to stay the course and ride it out. I mean, nobody knows what's going to happen with the election. And, you know, look at the last election, right? 98% of the polls and the pundits thought it was going to go one way, and it went a different way. Nobody could see COVID coming. Nobody could see 9/11 coming. So for some people, maybe that's 60% in stock. For some, maybe it's 50. For some, maybe it's 40. I think, you know, if there's a, you know, silver lining in this from an investment standpoint, I think it taught a lot of people about their own real risk tolerance. You know, it's really easy to say that you have a high risk tolerance when the market's going up for 10 years, right? And something like this happens, okay, now you kind of see, are you really willing to expose yourself to X amount in the stock market based on your own situation, your own stage in life? And so take this as a learning opportunity, put yourself in the proper position so that you can handle whatever comes down the pike. You know, we talk about that all the time. It's all about balanced portfolios, proper asset allocation for your own needs and your own risk tolerance.
Dave, any final thoughts from you today?
I think Mark puts up a really good point, and that is just, you know, you have to put yourself in a position where you're not going to react in a knee-jerk reaction to what's going on out there. And your point about stocks being meaningfully expensive is a good one for people that are kind of arriving late to the party here. I'm getting a lot of calls about people feeling like they're missing out a little bit, and suddenly their courage is coming back, and they want to pile on. And I think it's the time to exercise caution at this point, until we really get a real good feel for what's going on with the pandemic before you start taking any type of outsized risks.
Great points all around. Well, that's the end of yet another Money Talk. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.